Naylor's Natter the Book, ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Naylor's Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of Naylor's Natter. And this week, I'm delighted to welcome Jade Pierce to the podcast. Welcome, Jade.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for having me finally. I mean, goodness me, listener, how long this has taken. This, I must stress, it's not Jade's fault, this. I keep setting these up and I keep letting her down. We finally got there in the end. And actually, it's better that we've waited, isn't it, with tonight's exciting announcements and developments around your upcoming book, which we will talk about fairly shortly. But if we can start, as we always do, with our nice, gentle introductory question. So can you just tell listeners a little bit about you and your journey in education to this point?
Yeah, so I'm currently an assistant head teacher in charge of teaching and learning and CPD at a high school in Staffordshire. I'm also an evidence lead in education for the Research School Network, and I am currently facilitating the MPQ in Leading Teacher Development for Ambition Institute. So that's me at the moment. And then journey through education, I'm a teacher of business studies and economics. I have been a head of house and a head of department, and then assistant head all at one school. So this is the school that I trained at actually, and then started at as an NQT, and I'm still there. And I think this is my 14th year this year, something like that.
Wow. So even more to discuss, Jade, than I thought originally, because you're leading on an MPQ as well, which is something that I'm going to shamelessly plug and flog later on, because I'm starting tomorrow night. It's a bit nervous. I'm starting MPQ LBC delivery tomorrow night for Teach First, actually, so that should be quite interesting as well. So we're going to chat about that later on.
Yeah, they're really good. I'm really impressed with them.
They are, aren't they? Yeah, well, I mean, I'm saying that I haven't started yet, so hopefully it will be. But yeah, that's good to hear. Right, okay. So we're going to talk about your book. So your book that's upcoming is with Bloomsbury. And again, I say this every week, we're not allowed to particularly plug certain companies because we don't take any money, Jade. I mean, if anyone's offering any, feel free, send them, but nobody does. So we don't plug any particular types of books. But obviously, I've got a book coming up with Bloomsbury, so we've got a particular soft spot for Bloomsbury as well.
Yes.
So the book is going to be called What Every Teacher Needs to Know, How to Embed Evidence-Informed Teaching and Learning into Your School. So I thought if we could weave that into the questions and start with a big question, if you like, but it does kind of tie into particularly sections 2 and 3 maybe of your book, which is, should evidence-informed practice be a whole school priority?
Well, obviously, from the title of the book, I'm definitely going to say yes. It's actually quite exciting. I haven't talked in depth about my book at all. So it's really nice to talk about it. It makes it seem very real. And yes, to answer your question, I think that it is crucial that we, as a school, are trying to be evidence-informed. And that if we've decided that we want teaching to be evidence-informed, that has to be a whole school priority. Certainly in my school, my head teacher stood up 5 or 6 years ago now, on September on an INSET day, and said, look, we're making the move towards evidence-informed teaching and learning. This is what it is. This is why we're doing it. And that really made sure that it was everyone in the school pulling in the same direction and working towards the same goal. And then it meant that it was front and central in our school development plan, in our departmental development plans, in everybody's performance management. And I think that just means that everyone sees it as their main role or their main priority, which is super important.
Definitely. And I mean, I'm just looking through, obviously, you know, the book's not quite out yet, but you've given me a kind of overview of what the book's going to look like. And having had a little bit of experience in this, and listeners will know my limited journey in evidence. So, you know, I was the loftily titled assistant director of the Blackpool Research School, a title that we made up well, I say made up, we pinched off Alex Quigley, who had it on his door at Huntingdon. So we thought, well, we'll call ourselves assistant directors as well, which was just basically two of us in a cupboard. But the reason I'm mentioning that is that when we started it off, it's probably a similar time to when you started at your school 5 or 6 years ago, we didn't have a great handle on what it meant to be research-led or evidence-informed. And, you know, I've joked before, you could have written what I knew about academic research on the back of a postage stamp. You know, it was very, very limited. So this book is really going to be useful for people that are, you know, starting their journey in evidence. Obviously, you're quite far down the road. And yeah, the first section that you've done is you've kind of distilled 20 of the most seminal pieces of education literature, yes, and you're going to try and make it much more sort of accessible. So talk to us a little bit about why you've done that summary and what kind of takeaways are going to be there.
Yeah, so basically, it actually came from a conversation that I had when I went on the Tea and Teaching podcast, and they had asked me about what, if you want to be evidence informed, where should you start? What should you read? And I started trying to think about, well, you should read, if you're interested in cognitive load theory, you should probably read these two or three things. If you're interested in this, you should probably read this, this, and this. And then I think I got to it, and it was, you know, 20 or 30 papers that if you wanted to even make a start, really, on evidence-informed teaching and learning, you would have to read. And I started looking at, well, how much is that? Because I'd read them all by this point, but obviously over a kind of a couple of year period. I thought, well, how much is it? And I think I printed it off, and it was, you know, a huge, huge stack of papers, and just seemed like a huge task for anybody who wanted to get up to speed quickly to do, really. And so the first section of the book is trying to make it easier for people who, we know in teaching, we're all massively time poor, and trying to make it easy for people who want to be evidence informed, but maybe don't have the time to sit and read paper after paper after paper. So that was the idea in that section, really.
Yeah, so go on, talk to us. So you've mentioned a couple of papers there. Give us some kind of headline papers that you think that teachers probably should read.
So I've tried to split it in the book into sections, and the first one, I actually can't remember my sections now, Phil, because I haven't looked at the book for a little bit, but the first one is about, there's a group around cognitive science, so we've got things like Deans for Impact, the paper that they've done, and then we've got some around general teaching and learning, so that would be like the Great Teacher Toolkit. In the cognitive science one, we've got things like Rosenshine's and really well-known ones, but then we've got Teaching the Science of Learning, which is a lesser-known one that looks into teaching strategies like retrieval practice, etc., to early teachers and to pupils. So trying to do a bit of a spread there. And then we've got some that look at very specific aspects of teaching. So we've got one on motivation, we've got generative learning, that kind of thing. So it's trying to give a spread of the papers that, if you are interested in teaching and learning, we'll get quoted and we'll get referenced, so you can kind of join the conversation. But then also trying to cover as many kind of areas of teaching and learning as possible, I think, as well.
Yeah, and I think it's really useful, Jade. I think you really do, because although you're immersed in it and you've got 5 to 6 years of your school's journey in it, and obviously you've been on a lot of podcasts talking about it, conferences go into it. You know, I say this every week on the show, you know, a lot of people in my own school don't know, one, I do a podcast. They certainly don't know, two, that I may have had any involvement in research and evidence-based practice. They probably don't. Well, they probably do know I've got a book out, because I leave like posters lying around in the office, you know, that sort of thing, trying desperately to flog it. But the point I'm making is these kind of books are really important to try and sort of disseminate what can be off-puttingly, you know, inaccessible evidence in some ways, and make it, you know, user-friendly. So, you know, on the wider point, how can teachers disseminate that research and evidence to other teachers?
Well, I think it partly links to what we've said already, which is that it really helps if we can summarise the main research for teachers, and not just that, but the main takeaways or the practical implications for their teaching, which is also what I've tried to do in that first section of the book as well, is not just summarise the paper, but also, okay, if you want to put this into practice, what does that actually look like? So I think doing that is super important. And then there's a couple of ways that I would do it at my school. So we have a staff guide for each of our teaching and learning priorities. And that really distills the evidence and gives lots of practical examples of how the strategy might be implemented in teaching. And then we have a longer teaching and learning newsletter, where I normally take a few things that I've read or a few aspects of pedagogy and try to bring together recent writing from other people. And that might be papers or blogs or anything that I've seen on Twitter, that kind of thing, and kind of summarise that for them. And then I suppose two other things that I've done is the book summaries, which if you follow me on Twitter, you'll have seen. And that's really to try and make that kind of depth of information really accessible to teachers and give them a taste of what they will get if they read the book. And then I've also done a series of kind of, I call them an introduction to guide. So it's lots and lots of evidence-informed aspects of teaching, and it's like a brief introduction to cognitive load theory or a brief introduction to explicit instruction. So a very brief introduction, as in some definitions and then some examples of strategies with some further reading. So I think anything like that is super helpful. And then in terms of like not just disseminating but getting to engage in research evidence, I think is really important, and we've kind of tried to move more to that in my school now, really, where it's not necessarily us just saying this is what the research says, but actually trying to get teachers to read the research for themselves as much as possible. And we've just found lots of ways in our CPD offer, to do that, and I know we'll speak about that later.
Yeah, we will. And actually, I mean, just going off a little bit about the MPQs, you know, something that I found is trying to get up to speed of being a facilitator is just how evidence and research informed they are, and how that's becoming normalized for the qualifications across that suite, you know, even with the early careers framework and all the MPQs as well. So that's quite a nice kind of link up and see that the way the profession's moving.
Yeah, I think from the initial teacher training framework to the ECF to the new MPQs, it is all very much evidence informed. It's all based on the cognitive science model of memory. It refers to cognitive load theory, and that's in all of the different qualifications. So I'm delivering the MPQLDT, but I've also designed some materials for the MPQs and the senior leadership qualifications, and this kind of thread is running through all of them now. That we are expecting, you know, you might be a head teacher who's only ever been in a pastoral role, but you're going to be expected and need to know about these really important areas as well. So definitely a move towards that across all areas of the profession, I think.
Definitely. And that's why I'm glad I'm speaking to you tonight, Jade, because, you know, I'm taking a step away from the behaviour side of things and into the teaching and learning part of things. And one of the first steps is I've actually had to set foot in a classroom this afternoon, which is, of course, probably a good idea if you're actually going to do some teaching and learning. So I'm glad that I'm chatting to you tonight about this, because hopefully I can pick up a few tips as well while we're at it. Right, you mentioned about CPD before. So why is sort of professional development so important for teachers?
Yeah, great question. I think really it's because CPD has the biggest impact on teacher quality, and teacher quality has the biggest impact on pupil outcomes, and therefore how, you know, how well they do at the end of school, what their opportunities are going forward, etc. So I don't think there's much more important that we can do, especially as senior leaders, really, than give opportunities for our teachers to really develop as much as they can. And we'll all have read papers like the Croft and Pepe paper that says that in schools with supportive environments, including high quality CPD, teachers improve faster, their impact on pupil outcomes is higher. You can, if you've got high quality CPD, it's the difference between having a new teacher or a teacher with 10 years experience. So just for the amount of impact it can have on teaching and learning and outcomes, I think.
Yeah, and you're talking part three, and we are going to touch on this in a minute, about your school journey over that 5 or 6 years. But do you mind just talking to the listener a little bit about what does your CPD structure look like at your school at the moment?
Yes, so my structure, I always try to describe it in a three-layer model, and that is whole school, departmental, and then individual. So our whole school layer, we have whole school teaching and learning priorities, and we've got four this year. And actually, this is the third year I think we've had these four priorities for. And that really is driving towards those whole school priorities. So there we use whole school teaching and learning briefings, where that would be your kind of standard CPD offer, where we introduce a new technique, we look at how it can be implemented most effectively, we look at examples of how it could be implemented, we look at the research that supports it and all that kind of thing. And then we use those sessions going forward as well to revisit each priority. So whether that be to make some refinements. So for example, when we launched retrieval practice 4 or 5 years ago, we really focused on factual recall. And then over time, we were able to refine that and say, actually, we should be looking at higher order retrieval practice and how might we implement that in our teaching. Or it might be that we just want to share really good practice that we've seen across the school, or it might be that we've realised there's been a misconception or we've missed something that we need to go back and readdress. So I think having that whole school element is really important. And then we have, like I said, a departmental element. There's two aspects to this, really. First of all, we have for each of our teaching and learning priorities, or anytime we introduce something new, we always give departmental time. And I think that's really important to allow our subject specialists to decide how, whatever the priority is, what that's going to look like in their subject area. We're very much tight but loose, I suppose, in our leadership, in that we will say we want you to introduce retrieval practice, or we want you to address literacy, but what that looks like in each subject can be completely different, and we trust our teachers and our middle leaders to decide what that should best look like in their subject area. So we always have some departmental time where they discuss, they look at subject specific examples, they make some decisions, they trial things, they go away, they come back and reflect on that. So I think that's super important. And then the second part of the departmental kind of layer is our subject knowledge and pedagogy sessions, which is an idea that I completely stole from Durrington Research School, and is basically our middle leaders, our subject leaders, leading their own CPD. And they decide the focus, and it can basically be looking at subject knowledge or how to teach a certain aspect, or it could be looking at some subject specific research as well. So that's our kind of departmental layer, and that's been really well received. And I think it's all about kind of empowering your middle leaders to really get involved and lead the development of the teachers in their department. And then we have a really big range of things that we can do individually. So, excuse me. In my school, we have two flexi days, flexi inset days, at the end of the school year, and teachers basically have to accrue hours to take those 2 days off. So they have 10 hours worth of training time that they've got to do throughout the year. And we put on lots of opportunities throughout the year for them to accrue those hours. So they can attend a research session, which is where they come and read some research, and we discuss that and how it might impact our practice. They can attend a pedagogy session where they come and someone will present to them and ask about an aspect of teaching and learning, and then they will come at, and then we'll discuss how that might change our teaching. Or they can do some independent reading, and we support that with reading lists and CPD library and that kind of thing. So there's that. And then on top of that, we also have lots of voluntary opportunities. So we have a teaching and learning research group, which again is where we come and come together and discuss some educational research. We have a teaching and learning inquiry group, which is us doing research ourselves. So we do a big literature review on a specific area of teaching, and then we go away and trial some strategies in our classrooms, and we keep coming back as a group and evaluating that. We have a pastoral research group as well. We've just launched, and I stole this from Sam Crome from Twitter, who says that he reads with his year team meetings. And I thought, oh, that's a brilliant idea. We're doing all this reading around teaching and learning, but we're not really as evidence informed towards our pastoral kind of care. So stole that idea and launched a pastoral research group at school. So basically lots and lots of opportunities to allow teachers to choose what they want to engage with research, but all driving towards this main goal of evidence-informed teaching and learning. That was really long.
That was absolutely brilliant. I mean, this is why I do this. I mean, it's just, I know that there'll be lots of people listening to this as well, but I'm just thinking, I'm writing notes for me here, Jade. I'm just thinking, this is brilliant for somebody who's just possibly getting into that role and wanting to know how to go about setting that up. And I've written so many things down there. I guess the question would be, and linking it back to the book, if somebody has, you know, just been given a post, maybe leading teaching and learning, or assistant head, deputy head, whatever it might be, you know, how did you go about 5-6 years ago kind of implementing that? Because presumably you didn't start with all of those things. So you wouldn't have necessarily been doing the teaching and learning research group, the teaching and learning, you know, it would have started perhaps with something, a big picture, and then kind of as it's got bigger, you've been able to kind of separate it out.
Yeah, exactly that. So I think, you know, I talk about it now and we do so much, and I know that that can be massively overwhelming, but I think it's really important to point out that has been, you know, a 6 or 7 year journey from initially me getting involved in kind of evidence-informed teaching and learning and then leading up to where we are today. So I would say if you're just starting off, you do need to make sure that your knowledge of evidence-informed teaching and learning is as strong as it possibly can be. And that's because I think the first thing that you need to do is look at your school and identify where your priorities are. So we've got our four teaching and learning priorities, but that will be completely different in another school. They won't always be the same. And so you've got to have a really clear idea of what you want teaching to look like to then be able to spot, well, actually, we're furthest away in these areas, or I think these are going to make the most difference to our pupils. So I think that's probably the first stage. And then I think that initial thing, actually, of agreeing as a school, our priority is evidence-informed teaching and learning, and it's going to be all departments and it's going to be all teachers is super important. And then I think you start off with the whole school priorities and leading your training towards that. And then everything else, I think you just add over time. So, you know, once you've got people kind of starting to work with these evidence-informed teaching and learning priorities, we found that people were really enthusiastic about it. They could see the difference to their teaching. They could see the difference to the pupils. They became interested in themselves. And then you could say, right, we'll start a teaching and learning research group because we know that people are now interested in evidence-informed teaching. And so, and then you can kind of, and then, like I've said, you know, it's only last year or this year really that I've launched the pastoral research group. So I think it's just starting off with your main priorities and really driving towards that and then kind of refining and adding as you go.
I think that's really important, and I think that's really great advice, Jade, because Emma, who's leading on our teaching and learning with previous guest Bernie Kay, who, you know, people will know, Emma's kind of started off, and we had a lot of interest in people who want to do lots of different things. So we had teaching and learning groups. We had all sorts of other, you know, reading groups, things like that were going on, but we hadn't decided on what the key priorities were. So we had lots of things going on, but they weren't necessarily joined up together to be able to say, well, this is the driving force for improving teaching and learning within the academy. So we kind of stripped it all back. Not that we want to discourage people at all from getting involved in teaching and learning groups, whatever it might be, because that will come with time. But it was almost like, you know, sort of playing golf in the dark. You know, we didn't know where the hole was. We're just talking about, well, this research, that research, what we're actually looking at. So she's done a really great job of stripping it back to just, at the moment, looking at instructional coaching and walkthroughs for some improvements of pedagogy in the classroom. And she's then done some subject knowledge enhancement strands that Bernie's kind of leading on, which are going to try and improve subject knowledge within, you know, departments. And then over time, you know, hopefully we can then start adding those bits. And you do, don't you? You get that momentum, don't you, going through. But I think that's really interesting how you've implemented that and how that kind of avoids, which we might talk about in a minute, those kind of lethal mutations of just jumping on the latest passing bandwagon that we think we've seen on Twitter.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And like I said earlier, I think this is the third or fourth year. I think it's the fourth year now. I lose track because of COVID, but I think it's the fourth year that we've had the same teaching and learning priorities for. And that is on purpose to make sure that they are fully embedded in everyone's teaching before we then move on. And I think if you do any more than that, or if you do any shorter time period in that and you think, well, we'll move on to the next thing, actually you're going to move on and these things will be forgotten. And, you know, we all know about habits and how difficult it is and how easy it is to go back to what you were doing previously and what you've been doing for the past however many years. So I do think it's really important to choose those kind of three or four main priorities and really stick with them and have, especially at the start. We now do, like, our teaching and learning group doesn't focus on our whole school priority. It focuses on normally what we're actually going to do the following year or if we're going to do anything new. But for a long time, everything drove towards those teaching and learning priorities. It's only as people who have become really confident with it that we've then started looking at other areas as well.
It's really great for people to listen to you say that because, you know, it can be overwhelming and it can be a lot to kind of take in when you do take one of these roles. And I said to you, I was quite honest at the beginning, you know, as someone as a loftily titled, named himself assistant director of a research school. And then we'd sit there in our research school cupboard and say, right, well, we've still got a job to do in school. We've still got some priorities for teaching and learning across, you know, Blackpool as well. And what are our priorities? And it's very easy to just get caught up with whatever EEF paper happened to have been released at that time. So, you know, there was a time when we thought metacognition was the answer to everything just because it was the latest course that we got. But actually, you know, and I'll give him a shout out, Simon Cox was really brave and just said, well, it might be a priority for some people, and we are going to lead courses on it, but it isn't a priority in school at the moment. We need to be looking at something else. So,
yes.
You know, it does kind of avoid potentially those lethal mutations. And again, I keep drawing it back to the book, Jay, because I think this will be really useful for somebody who is going to be getting involved in that role, because it does give you a chance to say, right, there's the combined sort of distilled wisdom of someone who's done this for 4 years, rather than just thinking, I've got to make a change really quick, I better do this. And it can really lead to those kind of lethal mutations as well, yes. Can't it?
Yeah, and I mean, for me, I'm super enthusiastic, and there's loads that I want everyone to introduce, and I want everyone to be managing cognitive load and to be aware of explicit instruction and to be doing retrieval practice and spacing and interleaving and you've really got to rein in your own enthusiasm that actually, no, we've said these four things or three things, however many it is, are the most important. That's what we're going to focus on, and everything else has got to wait. It's the thing of adding more and more and more, and actually all you're doing is lessening the impact of what you've done previously. So you've got to kind of resist that temptation, but it is hard to do.
Yeah, it is. Right, so in terms of that final section, you talk about the account of the research and literature in the area, and then you detail the school's journey. Now, you've talked a little bit about the school's journey, but you've mentioned that you've done some case studies from two more other school leaders. So do you want to tell listeners a little bit about what kind of people you've studied or spoken to, and how have they gone about reaching their goal in terms of evidence and research?
Yeah, so I haven't actually used case studies in the rest of the book. It's all just been very much much research, and these are the findings from these papers and that kind of thing. And I've really tried to keep it tight as possible to the research. But then in the last section, which is all about, well, how do you put that across? So we know what research evidence says now. So how do we put that in action? How do we actually implement that across our school? Like you say, I've done my school journey, but then actually, really good CPD looks very different in different schools, and I didn't want to not address something because it's just we just haven't happened to take that approach in my school. So for example, we don't use instructional coaching fully in my school. We do allow teachers to opt in to instructional coaching as part of their flexi and set days, but it's not something that we've launched whole school. And so I wanted to give people the chance to read about schools that had taken an equally good but different approach to their CPD. So the two people that are doing case studies are two brilliant assistant heads, or I think they're principals in their schools, but rather than assistant head teachers. But it's Rachel Ball and Alex Gordon, who people both know from Twitter and are brilliant teaching and learning leads and share loads and loads of stuff. So Rachel has done instructional coaching and has started launching that and writes really well about where they're at in their instructional coaching journey. And then I really liked Alex's approach because he's started new in post actually and has completely redone his school's teaching and learning principles. So that was really interesting. And then he also has a strand model to his CPD, which we don't use at all, but people kind of elect for the strand that they're on. And that might be new teachers or leadership, etc. And they do different CPD depending on that strand, which is an approach that I really liked, but just wasn't in my school. So I think it's really useful for people to be able to say, okay, well, Jay's done this, but Alex has done this and Rachel's done this. And you can kind of pick and choose what you think would work best in your school, which hopefully people will find useful.
They absolutely will. They absolutely will. So we've talked about why CPD is important, and you've talked about how you structure your CPD. So in terms of how do you make sure that the CPD is effective, and I kind of take back to one of my favourite early podcasts that we did, and I couldn't believe I got him, Jed, ages ago, which was Guskey. Thomas Guskey came on and had a conversation around effective CPD, which was just mind-blowing to say that I managed to get him on. Still one of my favourites, that. So talk to us a little bit about how you kind of judge whether CPD is effective and what kind of adjustments you make to that based on feedback maybe from staff, from, you know, whatever it might be.
So I'll go through what I think makes CPD effective first, if that's okay, and then I'll talk about Guskey's levels evaluation, because that's what we would use. So in terms of what makes it effective, I'm going to refer to two main sources here. So I'm going to talk about the TDT paper on developing great teaching, and then the recent paper from Sam Sims and Harry Fletcher Wood. And the reason I like both of those papers is because they don't look at forms of CPD. So they're not looking at, oh, that we should use instructional coaching or we should use personal learning communities. They're looking at what they call the active ingredients or mechanisms of effective CPD. So essentially, it doesn't really matter what form your CPD takes as long as it has these kind of active ingredients. So the first thing for me is that you need a CPD curriculum. And I know that curriculum is you know, massively in fashion, I suppose, at the moment. But the point here is that you have your priorities and you have a plan for you for a year, and it is planned in advance, and it's not just, oh, someone can do a session in this, or I saw this on Twitter yesterday, so I'm going to sit, that's going to be our new priority, or this is what I'm going to do my session on this time round. But actually, you've got your teaching learning priorities, and then that all your CPD is driving towards that. But also, just like we would with our pupils, that we are building on and making refinements and revisiting throughout the year as well. So I think that's really important. Linked to that is making sure that you are revisiting. So are you sharing best practice? Are you dropping into lessons and giving people feedback? Are you going into lessons looking at, as a school, actually, we need to work on this area of this priority and addressing that as much as you can? So I think that's really important. I think CPD has got to be relevant to participants' needs as much as you can. And I mean that in terms of their job role and their professional goals, but also where you can, differentiating for novice teachers or teachers that are novices in that specific area, I think is actually a better way to put it, all the way to teachers who already have a really good knowledge of the strategy. So I think that's really important as well. I think peer support, so not necessarily collaboration, but having opportunities to try things out in your teaching, maybe have someone come and observe you as a peer, to give you peer feedback, to reflect on what's gone well, to look at in your department with other members of your department, what do we think this is going to look like in our teaching? I think that's really, really important. I think we've spoken about choice already and trying to, yes, you are keeping it to those whole school priorities, but is there some element of choice that teachers can choose? Actually, I want to go to this research session or this pedagogy session. I want to focus a little bit more on this teaching and learning priority because I'm weaker in it, that kind of thing, I think, as well. I said subject-specific CPD in terms of making sure that you do give that time. If you are introducing these generic strategies, retrieval practice, literacy, challenge, whatever it might be, that you are giving departments time to come together as experts in their subject and really look at, we think this is how it's going to be implemented best in our subject and in our teaching and for our classes. And then I've said introducing new content has got to be done in a way that we know is most effective from our own teaching. So managing cognitive load, giving really clear explanations, giving credible sources, giving examples and non-examples, making sure you're clear on, this is the strategy, this is why it's effective, this is how it's implemented most effectively, so that your teachers are developing a really good understanding of the strategy and why it works, not just those kind of tips and tricks. And that's from Sarah Cotteringham, did a really good blog yesterday, I think, about teach CPD, not just being a list of tips and tricks, because the aim is for teachers to really understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. So I think that's really important as well. So that's the what I think effective CPD is. And then we would evaluate it, so do a couple of different ways. First of all, we want to see if it's having an impact on the actual teaching. So that is dropping into lessons, speaking to pupils, speaking to teachers, speaking to middle leaders, and talking to them about how, what are they doing? What changes are they making, etc. And then I think it's about... eventually, obviously, you'd look for differences in pupil outcomes. But before that, you're looking at, is it making a difference to, I don't know, formative assessment? Are teachers reporting that students are more confident? Are they reporting that students tend to have more knowledge retention? All that kind of thing. So I think there's lots you can do there.
I mean, this is very comprehensive. Thank you, Jade. You know, all sorts of information you can take away there. And if listeners are interested in going back, so obviously we've had the pleasure of interviewing both Harry and Sam for the podcast fairly recently about the CPD, obviously, that you're referencing there. A couple of questions to follow up on there, Jade, if I might do. So I'm interested that you've mentioned that you're doing some work around pastoral staff and actually trying to link into best evidence around that. And, you know, obviously, in the role that I've got, still got at the moment, and the role I've had previously, I'm borderline obsessed about behaviour. I mean, you can probably see behind me that Tom Bennett's, you know, he's on the wall behind me, and running the room is hiding up on there. So, what I'd be interested in, kind of two part question: one, what kind of CPD are you looking at in terms of behaviour, pastoral, safeguarding, etc. And the other one, and this is something that I had when I worked at the TDT quite a lot, is how do you engage non-teaching staff within your CPD offer? We've got a huge number of non-teaching staff, some of whom are responsible for leading provisions, leading groups, you know, doing some teaching as well. So how do you kind of engage them in the process when perhaps their working hours and contracts are slightly different as well?
Yeah, so the in terms of the pastoral element, we, like I said, we've got our pastoral reading group now, and I think that's going to be really important. And it kind of has echoed my original thought process around teaching. Like, discovering that teaching could be evidence informed was like mind blowing, and realizing that there were all these papers and that there are, you know, trials and experiments, etc. And I feel like it's a bit like that for pastoral care. I think lots of people see pastoral care as just being built on experience, and some people are better with the kids, and some people, and actually that's not true. There's lots of books and papers about pastoral care, and it is evidence informed, and it is based on case studies of what has worked and all that kind of thing. So I think that's really nice, and I'm hoping that we'll grow that. And then the other thing that we do is lots of our pedagogy sessions or our reading sessions are linked to pastoral care. So, for example, we'll look at TLAC for all of the classroom management strategies that they do. We had a session on developing positive classroom culture and all that kind of thing. So I think it's time to tie together the link between behaviour, curriculum and teaching and learning, and actually they all go together, don't they? Because if you can have the best curriculum in the world or the best pedagogy in the world, but if the pupils don't behave properly, well, they're not going to be effective anyway. And then really linking behaviour to learning and what are the behaviours that we need our pupils to achieve to make the most of their learning, etc. So I think that's nice as well. And then in terms of non-teaching staff, all the twilights and everything like that are open to all of our non-teaching staff. So all of our teaching assistants and all that kind of thing, all of our cover supervisors. So I think that's important. And then also, because we allow that independent element, staff can choose, actually, for me in my role, this reading is going to be really important, or attending this twilight session is going to be really important, like an external course or whatever. So I think allowing for that independent element is really crucial, so that you are maximising everybody's CPD, not just teaching.
Such great points, Jed, especially around the pastoral stuff. And I think you're right there. And I just writing down what you wrote. You know, some people, you know, seem to be much better, just naturally better with certain students, things like that. And, you know, I mean, I've worked across quite a few different schools over 20 plus years now. And, you know, you do feel like that, don't you? As in, like, some heads of year particularly are like superheroes that can sort everybody out. But actually, there are some skills, there are some techniques, and a lot of this would be evidence-based around how they seem to emit those superpowers, actually learned experience over time. And you can kind of distill that experience, can't you? And you can learn. Teach Like a Champion is a really kind of good place to start with that. But obviously Running the Room as well, and a lot of stuff that Sam Strickland has talked about as well. There's a lot of evidence based, and I'm pleased to see the kind of shift back towards pastoral as well, particularly, and I can't say post-pandemic, can I? Because, well, one look at our cover list, and I'm sure yours, will tell you that it's definitely not post-pandemic. So I think that's really important. And yeah, we're trying to engage. I'm not saying that the non-teacher staff are not engaged, but it's just different and more difficult potentially for them to engage in some of the way that we've structured our sessions. So we are kind of consciously trying to look at that. Right, moving on. So I know we've touched on this before, but again, in terms of listeners that are, you know, looking to pick up the book, so I'll give everyone a reminder. The book is going to be What Every Teacher Needs to Know, How to Embed Evidence-Informed Teaching and Learning in Your School. So if they are looking to embed a particular strategy, so they decided on their key priorities for the school or for themselves or for their role, you know, how do you go about embedding it? You've talked about the whole school stuff in terms of, you know, the whole school priorities, but if they're looking to embed a particular strategy, let's say retrieval practice, for example, how would you go about doing that across your faculty, your department, you know, your key stage, whatever it might be?
Talking to teachers about educational books, why we love them and how we use them in our classrooms. With guest authors, publishers, podcasters, and of course, teachers.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
So I think the first stage is about gathering evidence and making sure that you as the leader, whether that be in your own teaching or across your department or across your school, that you are super confident in your own knowledge of whatever strategy that you're trying to implement. And I keep talking about it, but it is really understanding, why is it effective? So if it's retrieval practice, you really need to have looked at, for example, the cognitive science model of memory, retrieval strength and storage strength, desirable difficulties. So it's not just a superficial understanding of, oh, retrieval practice is when we revisit from our long-term memory. It's yes, but why is that effective? How can we make it most effective? And really reading as much as you can. So I think that's the first stage. Then I think it's really important to do a trial. So like I said, we use our teaching and learning inquiry group now to trial the strategies that we're going to implement in the future. So for example, we've worked out from our lesson drop-ins that as a school, we want to do some work on questioning and checking for understanding. And so our teaching and learning inquiry group this year is focusing on that. And that enables, one, lots of members of staff to build up their knowledge before we introduce a whole school. So every department's got someone who already knows quite a lot, is a champion of what we're going to recommend, but also lets us as a school work out how does the research best look, what does the research look like in our context, what works best with our pupils in our classrooms, etc. So I think that's really, really powerful. And that might just be, if you're a head of department, you try it in your lessons before you introduce it to everybody else. And that's certainly a strategy that I use when I was head of department as well. And then it's introducing it to your staff. So we've spoken a little bit there about, you know, what you can do to make that introduction effective. So making sure that you're explaining the strategy clearly, making sure that you are looking at why it's effective, that you really specify research. We found that with our staff to be really powerful, not just saying the research says, or for example, the testing effect is this, but actually referring to individual studies and saying, this is what the testing effect says. This is an example of a paper that demonstrated the testing effect. This was the experiment. These were the results. And we found that really helps to get staff buy-in, that actually they can see, there's actual real research that's been done. It's not just someone standing up and saying, well, you should do retrieval practice because it improves long-term memory. So I think that's really important. And then, like I say, giving lots of examples about effective or ineffective implementation and what it might look like in different subjects, just to help teachers as much as you can. And then I think after that, if it is whole school, making sure that you give people time to reflect on what it's going to look like in their teaching and their subject, and doing that collaborative if you can, then you go for it, you implement it, you trial it, you see what happens. And then you've got to keep revisiting. So, okay, we tried this. How is it working? This has worked. This hasn't worked. What do we need to do to improve? Get into lessons, have a look at what's going on as a department. What do we need to do? What's working really well? What can we kind of standardize across the department? What do we need to do a bit of extra CPD on? All that kind of thing. And then keep revisiting and keep improving over time.
Brilliant. And in terms of, you know, that lethal mutations that Dylan William talked about and you alluded to earlier on, I think that the sentence, the research is clear, or the research says, has become a lethal mutation by itself, hasn't it? You know,
yeah.
I mean, I better not talk about RSLT meetings because, you know, we don't do that, obviously. You know, he says.
Oh, I say it all the time.
I'm glad you said that.
Well, the research says that. And then I think, Hold on, some research may suggest that. And I have to change it. I do it all the time. I'm awful. Especially when you've read a lot and in your mind it's kind of solidified into the research says. So I think we have to be careful ourselves of that, definitely. But yeah, I think lethal mutations is really easy in teaching, especially if you are trying to distill stuff down and make it as easy as possible for teachers, you know, to understand and to implement. And so you can say, right, well, one way to do retrieval practice is to do a 10-question quiz. And then everyone can start doing 10-question quiz. But actually, some of them aren't doing it from memory. Some of them are doing stuff that they did recently rather than leaving a proper gap. Some of them are doing really poor quality questions so that the retrieval that people are doing aren't going to be powerful. Some of them aren't giving corrective feedback. So I think it's that I think is really important to prevent the lethal mutations, the understanding why it works and then being really clear on how does it work most effectively, not just how does it work, but actually what can we do to make sure we get the most out of it. I think that's really important as well.
Definitely. And I kind of changed my mind on lethal mutations because, you know, when I had the privileged position of being in the research school and actually, you know, we're teaching for 3 days. Well, I say teaching, you know, teaching for 2/3 of 3 days and having 2 days, you know, to do all the other stuff. It was easy to kind of say, well, those that are kind of parroting lethal mutations are in some ways disingenuous and they're deliberately sort of doing this because it will further their career or it will make their... But actually, a lot of the lethal mutations are actually accidental, aren't they? Because you've got extremely busy teachers. So, you know, you're assistant ed teacher. You'll have a very sizable teaching load as well, won't you? Alongside your day job, and it's difficult to find the time to do all that research evidence. Which again, you know, he says plug for book is exactly why this is very useful, because people will be able to pick this up, won't they, and be able to kind of distill a lot of that down rather than having to spend hours and hours and hours on top of everything else that we're having to do at the moment.
Yes. And that's what I've tried to do in the second part of the book for those things that I think are the kind of most important elements of evidence-informed teaching and learning, or maybe most applicable to most settings. I've tried to summarize not just what is retrieval practice or what is explicit instruction, but actually this is how you implement it most successfully. So I'm hoping that will be helpful. And I agree. I think there's very few teachers who will deliberately think, well, I'm going to implement this idea really badly. And there's very few senior leaders who think, well, I'm power crazy and I want everyone to do exactly as I say, and so I'm going to make everyone do it in exactly the same way. I think it comes from a place of, we want everyone to be consistent, we think we've got something that works, so we want it's easier to judge, it's easier to see if people are doing it, so we're going to get everyone to do it in the same way. But actually I think that's probably where most lethal mutations come from. It's trying to be generic and trying to make everything the same across all subjects, year groups, whatever it is. I think actually if you can let teachers make the decision and departments make the decision about what a generic strategy looks like, that will probably prevent most lethal mutations.
And it was that language around rapid improvement as well, wasn't it? You know, I've worked in all categories of schools, and I don't necessarily need to talk about Ofsted for better or worse, but, you know, when you're in a difficult situation and rapid improvement is needed, it's quite often easy to hitch yourself to whatever passing bandwagon is favourable at the moment, whether you're, like you said before, oh, well, let's do something with the curriculum, let's do something with evidence and research informed practice, and just do it really quickly. And by nature of doing it really quickly, you've only got a surface understanding of it, and you implement something really, really quickly, and that's where this can happen. So I'm really, and our listeners will also be encouraged to hear about, you know, yours has been a very gradual, slow journey over time that has reaped all these rewards. But also, you know, you're getting all these networking as well, aren't you? You're speaking to lots of different people from different schools, and it's kind of building that momentum as a profession as well, that's taking that time and careful implementation.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think if you can do less, better over a longer period, you're probably on the right track. And that's way cleverer people than me have kind of come to that conclusion. And I'm just massively stealing that kind of philosophy there. But I definitely think that's true, and definitely has proved to be true in my school, I think.
Definitely. And all that stuff around habits as well, which is, you know, something I'm massively into at the moment, all of these different habits, and the stuff that, you know, Harry Fletcher Wood particularly talked about, really, really important to keep, you know, keep doing all of those things, and you will kind of see the improvements over time. And that rapid improvement is not as kind of important then, is it?
Yeah. And you're not going to see that long-term change in habits if you can only focus on whatever you're focusing on for a term, and then you move on, then you move on, then you move on, then you move on. Or you are, but it's going to always be done, just done, but not done really, really well, which I think is a big difference.
Well, that's an interesting one, Jay, because, I mean, this is something that I did at the SLT last week, and perhaps, you know, I'm starting to think I was quite possibly wrong about this, because we had an argument about, sorry, argument, it sounds terrible, doesn't it? Cut that part. We had a discussion around, we're trying to implement certain strategies for teaching and learning into the classroom to match up with our school routine. So an example would be, we're doing something called collect and inspect, which is basically meet and greet, but it's my fancy version of it. But then we thought, well, we'll tie that as a behaviour CPD alongside something like, Do Now from Doug Lamov, and they come into the classroom. And, you know, so people far more educated than me around the SLT table said, well, we need to embed that first before we move on to another priority. And I was almost of the opinion, well, perhaps we need to cover more surface level to get some kind of traction on teaching and learning. But, you know, talking to you tonight, I'm starting to think that the people that were saying that I was wrong are right, as usual, because I nearly always am. And perhaps, you know, concentrating on embedding one or two or three things is more important than just covering everything, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, our teaching and learning priorities are quite wide. So that does give you some scope to feel like you are addressing more. You know, it's not a teaching learning priority isn't like a do now, for example. It would be retrieval practice or spaced retrieval practice as a whole. So that it, but yes, I do agree. I think if you can really embed something, it's probably better to embed and then build on that than to try and do lots and lots at the same time.
Great stuff. Right. Okay. So we're getting towards the end of the questions, and we may have a couple of things to announce at the end. I may be stepping into the vinyl suite with you, Joe. We haven't done this for a while, but I may be talking music later. I know.
Nice.
I know. Right. Obviously, you've talked about the different papers that you've distilled down. There's 20 papers, but have you got maybe a top one or a top three education papers that, alongside people going out and pre-ordering your book, is it available for pre-order already?
Not yet, no.
Oh, okay. Well, when it is, available for pre-order, they can go and pre-order it. But it's, you know, alongside buying your book, are there some education papers that you think all teachers must read?
Yes, this is really tricky, obviously, because I chose 20 and that was hard enough. But I'm going to go for The Great Teaching Toolkit, The Great Teacher Toolkit, just because it covers lots and lots of areas of teaching. So I think that's really great. I'm going to go for Putting Students on the Path to Guided Learning, because that was the first paper that I read about explicit instruction. And I trained in the discovery learning era. And that was the first paper where I thought, oh, thank God, you know, I don't have to have them running around the room, and I don't have to have them guessing about what things are. I can just tell them. So that was really nice. And then I'm going to go for Rosenshine's Principles, just because, again, I think it's such a lovely, wide-ranging introduction to explicit instruction, but includes so many really important techniques, explanations, review, modelling, scaffolding, etc.
Nailers, Natter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, right. So in terms of the book, let's do some signposting. So obviously people can find stuff about you from Twitter, but they can find out about your blog and all of your writing as well. But just, you know, tell us a little bit about where you can find more about you on the social media, and a little bit about timeline for the book. When's it going to be out? Where you're going to be speaking about it? That kind of thing.
So social media, I'm at Pierce Mrs. because I'm J Pierce, and my link to my blog, because I forget the name of the blog, is on my social media. And if you go to the pinned tweet on my profile, you'll see all of the stuff that I've done, and you can download this in my Dropbox, so everyone is more than welcome to download that. And there's lots of stuff for our teaching and learning group, so papers that we've read, questions that we've used, summaries, book summaries, and then any training that I've delivered, etc. Everyone can kind of help themselves to that. In terms of the book, so I think pre-order will be April. I'm just waiting for the final kind of edits from Bloomsbury and the final front cover design, which is exciting. And then I think it's ready to pre-order, and then hopefully it's the first book I've wrote, so I think it's about September for getting copies, I'm hoping. And then I'm speaking at Research Ed Warrington in April, and that should be quite nice. I'm talking about our journey, which isn't something that I've really spoke about before. I've said this is all the stuff that we've done, but not really how we got there. And I've actually got a timeline from kind of day one to 6 years later, and I'm going to look at what we've done and lessons that we've learned and things I would do differently and that kind of thing. So that should be nice. Yeah, I think that's it.
That's brilliant. And a great release date, by the way, a September release date. It's when everybody's just fresh back into school. That's perfect.
Yes. Enthusiastic and looking to learn, hopefully.
Well, exactly. And new in post and ready to start doing these kind of things. And Research Ed Warrington. Well, that's good. So I'm supposed to be going to Research Ed Warrington if Michael Childs replies to my begging messages on Twitter. Which I'm sure he will, or else he won't get invited on for a third time. So hopefully he will. So hopefully, you know, I might be able to get to come on and see you on there as well. That's brilliant.
Definitely.
Right. And other things to put you on the spot here is, so listener, I'm always conscious that, you know, in terms of my perceptions, my views, my ideas, I know the podcast's called Nailers Natter, and I've explained this a million times. It was never intended to be any more than one podcast, and it was only named after me because the Blackpool Research School were too embarrassed to put a podcast out in case it was rubbish. So it shouldn't have really had my name anyway. I'm waffling around saying that I'm hoping that Jade's going to be able to do one or two podcasts for us listeners, because that would be great, wouldn't it, to get Jade's view on the other side of things and for Jade to interview and, you know, get guests on that, that interest her and kind of widen our evidence and research-based network. So hopefully, Jade, you've got some kind of news for us about when that might be starting or who you might be interested in bringing on.
So I haven't asked anyone yet, Phil, so I won't give you names because then if I have to disappoint people, that'll be awful. But I'm thinking that I want to do two. I'd like to do one with other teaching and learning leads so we can have a really nice discussion about what are we focusing on, what are we finding works. And like I say, kind of in that third part of my book, I suppose, where we look at what other approaches can be taken to CPD, who's doing coaching, what have they found works well with coaching, who's doing stranded CPD, etc. So I think that would be good. And then I'd really like to do one just focusing on CPD and teacher education and really looking at how we can mobilise evidence most effectively in our schools from a CPD standpoint. So it's on my to-do list to get it organised and get it booked in.
Very, very excited, and I can hear the excitement, the buzz from the listener as we're thinking that's going to be coming up soon. So thank you, Jade, really appreciate that. Obviously what we'll do is we'll put signposts to other podcasts that you've done. So you've mentioned one on there. Obviously there's one that I particularly enjoyed with Darren, which was a great podcast on the Becoming Educated. So I'll put a signpost to that one as well. But just to say, one, thank you for bearing with me for such a long time and finally getting onto the podcast. Two, dead excited about the book. So again, hopefully we're going to get that coming out soon. And three, even more excited that you might be joining the team. So really can't wait to be working with you in the near future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Never Snatter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Never Snatter, just talking to teachers.
Naylor's Natter the Book. Ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Naylor's Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.